and Ayana. Council, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. When you start your principal argument, please state your name and the party you represent for the record. And then Council for Appellant has 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. We have a multitude of podiums and microphones, so for whatever your personal comfort levels are. If you want to go to the center podium, either or both of you, you're welcome to do that. That one has the advantage of it has a toggle switch, which will raise the podium up and down. And so it's a little bit more comfortable. The other ones are farther apart. If you prefer for safety to be farther apart, then you can just go there. The timer will be on the center podium showing, you know, the yellow and the red lights. So with that, Council for Appellant, if you are ready to go.
And I think the name tags are reversed here. Of the, I know which.
They are reversed. Oh. And I do think I'm seated in the wrong place. But if you go.
That's my error. Yes.
And I'm sorry. Because I should have mentioned it.
My mistake. Here.
But I
just want to make a switch so the party's just easier. Okay. Yeah, that was my mistake.
I know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that didn't interfere with your time.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Scott. I represent Trinity Home Healthcare Services and Etiani Ayana, who goes by Yanni. She's in the courtroom here. We're here on an appeal from an agency decision, the Commissioner of Human Services. And it's a final order that follows a lengthy proceeding that started with some notices that my client received in February of 2019. So this is the end, potentially, of what has been an ordeal for my client that started many, many years ago with some CSRS investigators coming into her business asking her for documents. And the way this works, and I'm going to really focus my argument this morning on two main points, the remand issue and the arbitrary and capricious argument that we've fully briefed in the principal and reply brief. But the way this background works is CSRS sends you a fax that says, make all of your records available. And then when they walk through the door, they say, we're just kidding, not all the records, it's just this list. So the business owner has to scramble and find not just, not all of the records, they have to find just a limited number of records. And the problem is that in this case, when we questioned the witnesses at the hearing about who was on that list, they did not know. I asked all the investigators who was on that list. They said they didn't know. Where's the piece of paper that was given to Ms. Ayana to find the right files? They didn't know where that paper was. They didn't present that at the hearing.
At the hearing, at the contested hearing, didn't your client have access to all of that information prior to the hearing?
She had
at the time of the hearing?
She had access to all of her files, but when we get to the hearing, the real gnawing question with this entire procedure is if a business is serving all of these individuals and all of these individuals are receiving care, and CSRS comes in and finds what is basically a dump truck load of missing documents, how in the world are all of the patients being served on a daily basis around the clock? There's a good example of a patient, a quadriplegic. Ms. Ayana, she started her business basically around this man who is dissatisfied with his care. He then hired her, she hired other nurses, and Trinity was born from that experience. He required, I believe it was 8 to 10 nurses, because it's around-the-clock care for someone who cannot care for themselves. That one man represents a huge portion of what DHS is asking for back. They're saying, well, we want all of this money back.
So may I ask, are you complaining about the investigative process or some evidentiary failure at trial, at the trial?
I'm just providing a little bit of context about what ALJ Mortensen found is so unusual about this case, that you have all of this money that DHS is asking for back, and there is no complaint from a patient that said, I didn't receive care, I didn't receive $1.2 million worth of care.
Aren't there regulations, though, that indicate that you have to have specific information in order to get the payment through the department or from the government?
There are, and that's what this focused on, abuse. So abuse shows up in a regulation, and it's essentially defined in the regs, and it's expanded upon significantly so that it's almost like they want to argue that it has to be a paperwork perfection. Wisconsin Supreme Court dealt with this and said, we're not doing that in Wisconsin. And in Minnesota, that is not quite the requirement. There are more requirements around that abuse standard, but what they want to say is there was abuse because some records were missing. What we say is if you go back and you look at ALJ Mortensen's orders, he's repeatedly reiterating the fact that he can't tell what's missing. And frankly, our office spent a good year and a half trying to figure out from the spreadsheets what in the world DHS was saying was actually missing. Paralegal time, attorney time, 7,611 lines of spreadsheet. And they give you these spreadsheets and they say, your documents were deficient. Well, what documents? Produce to us what you have because we aren't sure what you have. We aren't sure what you took.
Wouldn't it be possible when you get the notice and it's line item, by recipient ID, by the service date, by the procedure code, by the unit's bill. I'm looking at the first one, the one that came in. Why would that be impossible for a provider to look at their files and see what they have?
It isn't impossible, and we did that. We submitted a lot of documents as well. Those are in the record. We provided an answer key, essentially, to how to read those documents in relation to the spreadsheet. And that's the problem. DHS did not do that at the hearing.
Right. Well, what DHS did, I understand, is that they submitted the summaries that have the line items that were in the notices. Then they submitted on DVDs the files that they had copied from the from Trinity. And I suppose if Trinity, you're suggesting, I guess, that those might not have actually been the files that were, in fact, photocopied or scanned at the time of the site visit. Is that the complaint? Are you suggesting that what was in the DVDs did not reflect what was actually scanned or available at the time of the site visit, and so you're having a complaint about the reliability of those underlying documents? Is that the complaint?
That's one of many. It's not the only one, and I don't want to get too tripped up on that one because I think this appeal is much simpler. Section 14.62 subdivision A says that an agency in this context has to make a decision to reject or modify or accept a decision by an ALJ within 90 days of that decision becoming final. Here, what the commissioner did is first the commissioner asked for more time, and the statute specifically says you can do that. You have to go back to the chief judge of the administrative office, ask for more time. The chief judge, in her order, is kind of flippant in saying, it looks like you need more time because you didn't organize the record the way you should have, and now you're having a really hard time figuring out what the record was. And that's exactly what ALJ Mortensen said. He said, I don't know how to make heads or tails of this. The spreadsheet itself is not a Rule 1006 summary. That's been talked about repeatedly by DHS. The spreadsheet contains all kinds of information that is not consistent with a Rule 1006 summary. Rule 1006 summary is the bank account had this much money in it on this date, and the bank account had this much money, and all you need to do is look at all these records that are either underneath the 1006 summary or sitting in a box in the back of the courtroom. Here, they acknowledge that there's lots of data in the spreadsheets that is not in the record. They take the date of the services being provided. They take the amount paid. That's not in the record. They take the amount that was overpaid. That's not in the record. These are all their assertions about what they believe the evidence shows, but it's not a summary of the evidence.
So let's focus on the remand, which is where I think you were headed for a moment. I think the authority to remand, right, which is not specific, I think, to the summary data, but just the authority to remand. I think, is your argument that the commissioner lacks authority in all cases to remand to an ALJ to consider an issue after the findings have been?
I wouldn't even expand it to all cases. There are some where a clear mistake is made. There's some case law where they kind of carve out these minor exceptions. None of those apply here. What the ALJ did.
But counsel, isn't your legal interpretation, I mean, the way that you're interpreting 14.62 would apply to all cases, that the that a remand order can never be a rejection of, can never be a rejection of the original OEH order?
I don't think so, because I think it doesn't affect the case law that says there's the ability to quickly correct an error. But this was not a rejection. This was not a modification. This was not an acceptance. Rejection would have been, we reject the whole thing, and we don't accept any of it.
Your concern that the agency didn't write in their order, we reject OEH's order and remand for them to, like, is the problem with the way the agency described their order, or is it that a remand can never be a rejection?
No, in this case, it's not. So it would be a hypothetical. What they said is, we want you, ALJ Mortensen, to go back to the drawing board and look at our evidence again and reach a conclusion that we want you to reach, not the conclusion that you already reached. So, and we talk about in our briefing.
Well, except it wasn't, I mean, doesn't the commissioner have the right to a record? And in this case, the commissioner basically said, I can't decide this case on this record, and it's because you misapplied rule 1006.
No, they're not. I would say no, they're not. They have to go on the record that they have. They can't. We've also cited case law that says the record closes when the record is when it's submitted. So you can't come back. The commissioner can't come back and say, wait a second, we didn't do an adequate job presenting a case for $1.2 million in a half a day or less than a day with two witnesses, and then come back later after all of this time has passed and a business has closed and basically laid off its employees and say, we didn't get it right the first time. We want another bite at the apple.
So I want to test what your rule is that you're asking us to apply. So let's say, for example, an ALJ had excluded all of a relator's testimony, wrongly refused to let the relator testify, wrongly refused to admit the relator's evidence, you know, made evidentiary errors, failed to consider a relevant factor, something like that, that's critical to a decision in a case. And that is final. It goes to the commissioner. The commissioner says, ALJ, no, you made legal mistakes here. You made evidentiary errors, and you failed to consider, let's say, some affirmative defense or something like that. You need to have a hearing on those items so we can make a decision about a relator. Can the commissioner remand in those circumstances to supplement the record and to actually address things that are necessary to be addressed?
I don't think they can, because under this statute, which the Supreme Court has been very clear, you can't read in additional terms in the statute.
So that sounds like a universal rule that there is no remand, or at least no remand that would include new evidence. I'm trying to figure out what your rule is that you want us to apply.
What I think is instructive and interesting is the state cited the Fallsgraf case. So what the problem with that case, and they use that as trying to suggest that there is a right to remand. If you look at the statute that was in effect when that remand for a new hearing occurred, the statute included the express words, you can remand.
So is your rule of thumb is that there's no remand?
I don't think it affects this clear error, or if you look at the Roe decision that's on page 2 of our reply memo, it's essentially an unemployment law decision where the court actually says The ULJ made a decision, and then the ULJ tried to change it. And the ULJ tried to change it after the 30 days had passed where the employee could contest or appeal.
Right.
They said, you can't do that. You can't wait until the employee's chance to appeal is gone and then make a decision. And there it's critical that the language that's used in that decision suggests strongly that there is an inherent authority, but it's not inconsistent. It can't be inconsistent with the plain language of a statute.
But by remanding it, isn't that a rejection of the record as it exists because of the application of a wrong evidentiary rule?
Not in this case. There was an order. And we know from that order that it was not a rejection. It was a request.
It's a rejection of the record as it existed. I don't know how else you could read that order except as a rejection.
Well,
of the record as it existed because of the failure of the ALJ to appropriately apply 1006, according to the commissioner.
But the statute doesn't refer to rejection of the record. It refers to rejection of the order or the findings. And so the statute itself is what controls this discussion. I want to just briefly touch on, too, Your Honors, the arbitrary and capricious standard. We've cited multiple examples in our briefing of where the administrative agency got this completely wrong, where they made findings that were inconsistent with the ALJ's findings. And I think if you go back and read both of the ALJ's findings, you have two orders after 3 days of hearings where this ALJ was basically pulling his hair out saying, this record makes it impossible for me to find what I need to find. And under those circumstances, we'd ask that this be overturned, reversed, and that the ALJ's first recommendation and order be the operative order in this case.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, isn't the status of the law, though, is as to the commissioner's decision, the commissioner doesn't have to adopt what the ALJ recommends. Am I correct?
That's absolutely right. We've actually cited that. I mean, you could read it right in our brief. But we've also cited examples of all of the ways that the commissioner had exercised her prejudgment in this case. It was almost like it was a foregone conclusion. I knew that I was going to at some point be standing here even after we won twice.
Well, but the commissioner had three investigators, the testimony of three investigators who said there's a chronic problem here with these records. This has been going on for a long time, and we just pulled out selected people. It was a random selection, and it shows that this is a chronic and widespread failure to provide the adequate records. Isn't that testimony sufficient to support a finding of abuse per se?
No, because there's a difference between credibility and the finding of credibility as to the investigators and the sufficiency of the evidence. Here, there is not sufficient evidence because the evidence was not connected, and there are a number of reasons why it wasn't connected, and I think it was because it was so confusing to the investigators and frankly to Judge Mortensen that it was almost undecipherable when you get to, you have a DVD with more than 10,000 pages on it and you have a 7,600 line spreadsheet and you expect the judge to figure out how those lines of spreadsheet should be interpreted based on the 15,000 pages you see on the DVD. And the DVD wasn't even available at trial. It was a DVD. There's no way to play it. There's no way to cross-examine a witness. It was a very unusual procedure to ask for $1.2 million. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You'll have time for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. I am Leonard Schweik, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Department of Human Services. On the question of substantial evidence and arbitrary and capriciousness.
Before we go there, do you mind if I start with the remand?
Sure.
How does this fit within the plain language of the rule that a decision or order that rejects or modifies must be completed within 90 days, or in this case, the extended period of time?
Points. One.
Why don't you think this is a rejection, or why didn't you argue it?
Well, it is a rejection because conclusion number four in the second report issued by the ALJ stated that it was a rejection of his first report explicitly.
And repeat that, would you?
Mm-hmm. Sure, if I may. Mm-hmm.
I just didn't see you argue it in your brief or call it that in your brief.
Yeah. It's addendum, appellant's addendum 71, conclusion of law number four. The commissioner timely rejected the judge's first report and remanded the matter. So the ALJ considered it a rejection.
Oh, the ALJ characterized it as a rejection.
Rejection.
Right.
That's
I was
correct.
Wondering why the commissioner in your brief, why you don't characterize it as a rejection. But are you saying to us now it is a rejection?
It is, in effect, a rejection because it's remanded to make other consideration of the record and the evidence.
And assuming that, and you would argue that you that there is implied authority to do a remand.
I don't mean to interrupt you, Your Honor. I'm sorry. There's inherent authority, as the Minnesota Supreme Court and this Court of Appeals has stated, and it's been well settled since 1958, that a commissioner of an agency has authority to correct remand decisions while it still has jurisdiction. And under these circumstances, the commissioner still had jurisdiction when she remanded it to the ALJ. And that's inherent authority,
inherent.
Which implies that it's not necessarily statutory authority, but there is inherent authority, is how the Minnesota Supreme Court and this court has applied it.
And are there any limits to that? What if a commissioner looked at that and thought, oh, you know, they really could have used a few more witnesses on this topic. Let's give them a second bite at the apple and let them put in more testimony. There's no legal error. They just want them. I mean, obviously, that would disrupt the whole time frame, which is meant to give a timely answer to licensees, et cetera. So is there any limit on that authority? Is there any judicial review of it?
There are limits, Your Honor. One is jurisdiction. Commissioner still has to have jurisdiction. Number two, any new proceeding on remand would have to be conducted in a way that did not prejudice the other party. In this situation, after remand, when the ALJ requested that the department take the spreadsheets and simply add the Bates number so they could correlate the date, et cetera, with the Bates number, the ALJ offered the appellant, the relator, an opportunity to cross-examine. They explicitly waived that opportunity, so they can't come here today when they had an opportunity with regard to any new information, which it wasn't new information. They had the Bates numbers since discovery. And I'd like to point out one other thing. With respect to the argument that it was so difficult to compare the spreadsheets to the records, not only did the DHS employees do that, who testified credibly and had no reason to obfuscate or not tell the truth, the relator herself testified that she was able to compare the spreadsheets with the documents that were in evidence. Further point out with regard to these summaries, as the court indicated, they were submitted and introduced pursuant to Rule 1006. There was no objection. There was no objection to the spreadsheets. There was no objection to the records that were introduced on the CD. There was never any objection to any of that.
To admission, but I mean, it doesn't just go to whether, I mean, the ALJ decided that the burden of proof was not met because it was difficult, I guess, for him to connect the summary and to look at a line item and find, if there's a challenge to that line item, to find the original documents from which that line item was drawn.
Well, that's what he claimed, and he used an example, and the example was a recipient by the name of J.N., and in that example, he talked about not knowing the difference between the LPN and the RN. On the page referred to, which is DHS number 10007, it's a page of the spreadsheet that not only has the name of the recipient, the code, which is for RN services, et cetera, but the document that was in evidence to support that is a document that, and that's DHS 1810, That document is signed by a licensed practical nurse, Heldreen Mabu. Now, number one, the respondent would know that Ms. Mabu is a licensed practical nurse and not an RN, even though that line on the spreadsheet verifies that they billed for RN services. Furthermore, the Board of Nursing has Ms. Mabu listed as a licensed practical nurse. So on that line for February 23rd or 24th, as referenced by the ALJ, the information was more than sufficient to indicate that the RN rate was billed instead of the LPN rate. There was more than adequate information there. And again, the later admitted it herself that she was able to compare those records.
Counsel, I have two questions about the remand. The first one, and that I struggle with, is sort of reading Chapter 14 as a whole. So I do think that there's something to appellant's argument that in 14.62 it doesn't explicitly have the word remand, when if you look at 14.69, the legislature explicitly includes remand as one of the judicial remedies. I guess, how do you respond to those differences in the provisions within Chapter 14 in terms of remand as a appropriate remedy?
I go back to the Supreme Court's decisions that we've cited and this Court of Appeals decisions that we've cited, that a agency head has inherent authority to correct or modify their decisions as long as they still have jurisdiction. So that
so
inherent
is it,
power
yes,
would not
so,
be... I'm sorry.
Oh, is it your position then that do those cases predate the adoption of 14.62 so that at the time the legislature enacted 14.62, that was an existing... that was an existing law that was, you know, incorporated with the creation of 14.62?
Some do and some do not.
Okay.
The 1958 and 1960 decisions I'm not sure about, but the Roe decision cited by the relator does. And that Roe decision, the court stated, Minnesota case law has long recognized, however, that administrative agencies have the inherent power to correct erroneous decisions when the statute does not prohibit such correction and the rights of the parties are not prejudiced. Court went on to state, and the analogy drawn by the Fallsgraf case by relators incorrect, that case turned on whether the chairman of a tribunal had authority to remand, not whether the statute provided the commissioner with the authority to remand. And referring to Fallsgraf, the court stated, we noted that the chairman's reversal came within the 30-day appeal period, and reasoned that because the amended decision was later vacated and the matter remanded for an evidentiary hearing, new evidence, the relator was not prejudiced by the irregularities in the case. Same similar situation here. On remand, the relator had an opportunity to cross-examine based on now the Bates numbers being on the same page as the spreadsheets. So under those decisions, that's what we base our argument on.
Yeah.
Well, could I, as I understand, our role here is to look at the record and see if there's any supporting evidence in the record that would support the findings of the commissioner. Am I correct that that's our role?
Yes, to determine whether there's substantial evidence that supports the record.
All right, and I have to go. I want to go to the amounts because neither brief discussed the amounts that the commissioner found. Except, I do know that the relator or the appellant here did say we've got three investigators. They all came up with different amounts of money that was supposedly overpaid, yet. How are we as a reviewing court going to determine how the commissioner reached the amount that the commissioner reached based on this record?
Yeah.
How would we know? I mean, because I she found all three investigators credible, so that doesn't help us.
Yes, the investigators looked at different records at different times. There was one or two investigators that did spreadsheets following a 2016 on-site review. Then there was another review in 2018. So the spreadsheets, by the very nature of new information and two different review periods, had to be updated and that type of thing. One difference in amount was $37 out of over $500,000. The other one was closer to $55,000. In my view, that all of those irregularities, as the relator would call them, should have been done on cross-examination. When the record's examined, the relator did not cross-examine any of the DHS witnesses with regard to any of the line items on the spreadsheets versus the documentation.
But counsel, isn't it DHS's burden to show by preponderance of the evidence?
Yes, it is.
I do think that there's something to that argument where, you're essentially arguing that because they didn't cross-examine that somehow absolves the fact that, you know, we have three different numbers. And I do think that the law would say that it's DHS's burden to show by preponderance of the evidence that the commissioner came to the correct number.
Yes, and following the hearing and the remand, that's exactly what the commissioner did find.
But what in this record supports the finding of the commissioner as to the amount? What can you point us to?
Number one, the summaries. And with regard to Rule 1006, the actual documentation that supports the summary does not have to be admitted to evidence unless the judge orders it to. The judge did not order that in this case. We voluntarily put those records into evidence. Moreover, and there's two points, or several. One is the ALJ found that the relator was not credible. The ALJ found that the documents that the relator put into evidence should not be given any weight at all because she was not honest about what the records were given to the others. The ALJ, and it's not disputed, found that all three witnesses testified credibly. And then we look to the admissions against interest by the relator. She admitted that she made claims that lacked the requisite information. She admitted that there were errors in the documents upon which they were based. Submitted claims for herself even though she did not provide the services. She admitted that she submitted claims when there was no corresponding timesheet. She admitted that she overbilled for services rendered. She admitted that she altered PCA timesheets. So here's admissions by the relator compared to the testimony of credible witnesses from DHS who said basically those final, spreadsheets were correct. And what I think it goes to, quite frankly, is how careful the investigators were once they got information and once another investigator looked at it to go through and out of $680,000 find a $37 error and make that correction.
How many recipients were at issue?
I think about 15. There were four with regard to one review period and others. And with regard to the comments about that, that is exactly what an audit type situation is. Make your records available. They do not, and this was testimony in the case, provide advance information to avoid the very situation we have here where documents are created after the fact.
So it was about 15 recipients, but a heap of money related to those recipients.
Yeah, and that's what actually goes to the nature, chronicity, and severity of this. Because if we look at a period of time in terms of the chronicity, that we have about approximately 6 to 8 months, several months in 2015 and 2018. And within that time period, DHS discovered that there was over $1.23 million worth of billing that was not correctly supported by documentation. There was a staggering amount of situations where there was no documentation. So there would be no way in a spreadsheet to point to a document in evidence in any event.
So I wanted to ask about that because one of the arguments that I heard from appellant's counsel is that this isn't actually a summary document because a summary, you'd be able to look at the banker's box and find it. And what this document is, the spreadsheet, I mean, I think maybe even when the Bates numbers were entered, a majority of the entries still have no Bates numbers because, in fact, there's an absence of documentation,
correct,
right? So when you say that we produced all the documents that supported this spreadsheet, actually a lot of the there those documents, in fact, don't appear on a DVD because they're missing. That's actually the fundamental problem. Instead, the information is drawn on what was billed and what it was, blah, 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 presumably from a database that the agency has. Is that right?
Correct.
Was there anything at the hearing about, I'm going over a little bit, my apologies, about that?
Yes.
Okay. And challenges to the accuracy of that or not?
No. At least one investigator testified as to where they draw the from where they draw the information, et cetera. And Ms. Iana testified herself that the bills are, it's all in electronic format and that type of thing, so it has to be pulled by databases. Moreover, there's absolutely no claim in this case, and it's never been argued, that the amounts listed were not actually paid to Trinity. My time is up, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to address a few points, and I want to kind of track with some of the arguments that were just made. This suggestion that inherent authority can be inconsistent with a statute is the biggest problem with the inherent authority argument. I was following along in the Roe case as it was being read. There's more to the Roe case. If you look at page 2 of our reply brief, we cite the most important piece of the Roe decision, at least for purposes of this case. And that quote on page 2 of our brief is, in Roe, the court wrote that although an administrative agency has inherent power to correct decisions, this power is curtailed by statutory language providing a specified period of time when an agency decision becomes final. Here, this is not a rejection. And anyone looking at this remand order and the way it was essentially framed is the context for this is that first the agency asks for more time. The chief judge of the administrative law office gives partial grant of that additional time. And then instead of doing the work in the time that was granted, the agency then gives itself an additional 10 months. What we have here is a statute that says 90 days. You have to do it in 90 days. And what actually happened is this remand turned into a 10-month extension that the agency gave itself. If you read the case law and you specifically look at Roe, it talks about timely, prompt, quick. It talks a lot about how long it took and the prejudice that occurs if it goes longer. Clearly, we argued prejudice in our briefing. I think that's a problem for the state because that whole quote, that whole line of case law is contingent on whether there is prejudice. And here there clearly has been prejudice to a party that has a 90-day expectation, and it turns into a 10-month expectation. I want to address, too, this suggestion that Ms. Iana admitted that there were mistakes or admitted that $1.2 million of mistakes were made. That is a mischaracterization of the record. She admitted that, yes, these individuals are oftentimes family members who are providing care for their family members. So you have a son providing care for his father. You have lay people essentially providing care that is needed by someone that's approved in advance, and they make a mistake on their time card. She admitted that there were some mistakes. But in a business like this, where you have all these people submitting information to your business, the bottom line is that there were not specific examples of mistakes that were $1.2 million of mistakes. And the court is exactly right. In 1006 summary requires that you provide all of the information, and not all of the information was available. This database was a big blank in the 1006 summary. And I think the problem that ALJ Mortensen...
What did you expect the agency to produce if it's a database of units billed and paid?
If I'm a commercial litigation attorney, not really someone who does this kind of work on a regular basis. If I went into court and presented a case in a half a day for $1.2 million and it was $20 at a time, $40 at a time, $80 at a time, I would expect to be held to a standard where I would have to prove each line item on a database and not come in and say...
Did you think that they were going to go through line by line 7,000 and show... I mean, I'm wondering specifically about, I think they testified to, we went into their database, we created a spreadsheet, we eliminated some fields that weren't relevant, we eliminated payments where there's not an issue, and we created a spreadsheet and then added where the documentation supported it. Why isn't that good enough?
Because it doesn't allow a finder of fact to actually make a decision. So they present this 1006 summary that's not actually a 1006 summary, and it includes all of this additional conjecture, essentially their position, their argument. And in order to figure out what they're arguing, you'd have to go to every one of those 15,000 pages on the DVDs, and you'd have to look at every line on the spreadsheet where it says no documents, and you'd have to look at every single document that was in the spreadsheets. ALJ Mortensen said, this is not how this process should work. I can't figure it out. You didn't present it in a way that's intelligible. And so
how should they have presented the absence of documentation at the site visit?
Specifically, there are lots of examples of how that could have been done, but they didn't do it.
How would you, like, assuming there's no argument about the amount billed and the amount paid, because I didn't see that argument in there. So you have a name, a date, amount billed, amount paid, no documentation. What evidence would you expect the witness, like, what would you hand a witness to say, here's, you know, what does this show? How do you show that lack?
Well, you would show that lack by saying, we went and we talked to this person. They never had a care plan. There was never a care plan present in their home. There's lots of ways to prove the absence of a record and the absence of the services being provided.
So should they have just affirmatively, as part of their case in chief, go through each of these and have the investigator testify that they found no?
Part of the problem, I think, when you have a small case, $5,000, mm-hmm. you do that.
Right.
When you have $1.2 million, you sort of just, I want to say you fudge a little bit. You don't put in the evidence that you should put in if the case was smaller. But the complexity of this case is part of the reason. It should have been a three-week trial. And they present this case in basically a half a day with witnesses who haven't even seen the documents that are on the DVDs.
Okay.
So that's in the record.
Thank
so we
you.
Ask that the decision from the first recommendation be adopted by this court.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for your briefing and your arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. We're now going to recess to get to our next Zoom argument.